deal with these directions, the negotiation of the Kyoto Protocol and its rule book, the complexity of the negotiations, however, meant the considerable, quote, unfinished business, end quote, remained even after the Kyoto Protocol itself was adopted. The protocol sketched out the basic features of its, quote, unquote, mechanisms and compliance system, for example, but did not flesh out the all-important rules of how they would operate. Although 84 countries signed the protocol, indicating that they intended to ratify, many were reluctant to actually do so and bring the protocol into force before having a clearer picture of the treaty's rule book. A new record of negotiations was therefore launched to flesh out the Kyoto Protocol's rule book, conducted in parallel with negotiations on ongoing issues under the convention. This round finally culminated at COP7 with the adoption of the Marrakesh Accords, setting out detailed rules for the implementation of the Kyoto Protocol. As discussed here, the Marrakesh Accords also took some important steps forwards regarding the implementation of the convention. The 1997 Kyoto Protocol shares the convention's objective, principles, and institutions, but significantly strengthens the convention by committing Annex I parties to individual, legally binding targets to limit or reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Only parties to the convention that have also become parties to the protocol, however, that is by ratifying, accepting, approving, or acceding to it, will be bound by the protocol's commitments once it comes into force. The individual targets for Annex I parties are listed in the Kyoto Protocol's Annex B. These add up to a total cut in greenhouse gas emissions of at least 5% from 1990 levels in the commitment period 2008 to 2012. So, in Bonn, Germany, 18 November 2004, the 90-day countdown to the Kyoto Protocol's entry into force was triggered by the receipt of the Russian Federation's instrument of ratification by the United Nations Secretary General. The protocol will become legally binding on its 128 parties on 16 February 2005. 21 days from now, according to this information from the UNFCCC website, which we're going to try and get on the website if I can impose on Darren to do so. Keep all this last hour in mind as I continue, because this is all very, very important to the Hegelian dialectic being engineered at us and on us. The average temperature of the Earth's surface has risen by 0.6 degrees centigrade since late 1800s. It is expected to increase by another 1.4 to 5.8 degrees centigrade by the year 2100. A rapid and profound change. Even if the minimum predicted increases takes place, it will be larger than any century-long trend in the last 10,000 years. How do they know this? How can they say a thing like this? How can this be the truth? The principal reason for the mounting thermometer is a century and a half of industrialization. That's right. The principal reason for the mounting thermometer is a century and a half of industrialization, the burning of ever greater quantities of oil, gasoline, and coal, the cutting of forests, and the practice of certain farming methods. These activities have increased the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, especially carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. Such gases occur naturally. They are critical for life on Earth. They keep some of the sun's carbon dioxide, methane, and They keep some of the sun's warmth from reflecting back into space. And without them, the world would be a cold and barren place. But in augmented and increasing quantities, they are pushing the global temperature to artificially high levels and altering the climate. The 1990s appear to have been the warmest decade of the last millennium, and 1998 the warmest year. Climate change can be difficult. You can ask the dinosaurs if they weren't extinct. What a statement to make. What a ludicrous, ridiculous, redundant statement to make. Climate change can be difficult. You could ask the dinosaurs if they weren't extinct. Why would we ask a dinosaur anything? And could we communicate with dinosaurs? The prevailing theory is that they didn't survive when a giant asteroid struck the Earth 65 million years ago, spewing so much dust into the air that sunlight was greatly reduced, temperatures plummeted, many plants didn't grow, and the food chain collapsed. What happened to the dinosaurs is a rare example of climate change, more rapid than humans are now inflicting on themselves, but not the only one. Research on ice cores and lake sediments shows that the climate system has suffered other abrupt fluctuations in the distant past. The climate appears to have been tipping points that can send it into sharp lurches and rebounds, although scientists are still analyzing what happened during those earlier events. It's clear that an overstressed world with 6.3 billion people is a risky place to be carrying out uncontrolled experiments with the climate. Amazing. Once again, that paragraph needs to be heard again. What happened to the dinosaurs is a rare example of climate change more rapid than humans are now inflicting on themselves, but not the only one. Research on ice cores and lake sediments shows that the climate system has suffered other abrupt fluctuations in the distant past. The climate appears to have been, quote, tipping points, end quote, that can send it into sharp lurches and rebounds. Although scientists are still analyzing what happened during those earlier events, it's clear that an overstressed world with 6.3 billion people is a risky place to be carrying out uncontrolled experiments with the climate. The current warming trend is expected to cause extinctions. Numerous plant and animal species already weakened by pollution and loss of habitat are not expected to survive the next 100 years. Human beings, while not threatened in this new way, are likely to face mounting difficulties. Recent severe storms, floods, and droughts, for example, appear to show that computer models predicting more frequent, quote, extreme weather events, end quote, are on target. See why I covered so much in the first hour of weather warfare? Because the Hegelian dialectic is running rampant in the UN system. And these are extremely serious times to be accepting any more directions from the UN system. State Department has the U.S. mission in the United Nations. This continues on an ongoing basis. They go on to state, the average sea level rose by 10 to 20 cm during the 20th century, and an additional increase of 9 to 88 cm is expected by the year 2100. Higher temperatures cause ocean volume to expand, and melting glaciers and ice caps add more water. If the higher end of scale is reached, the sea could overflow the heavily populated coastlines of such countries as Bangladesh, caused the disappearance of some nations entirely, such as the island state of Maldives. Isn't that interesting? foul freshwater supplies for billions of people and spur mass migrations. Oh, man. So right on the money to what just happened with the tsunami. And the ocean's level rising. It's ridiculous. What's more ridiculous is the fact that the UN system is claiming that water is going to be the precious commodity of the 21st century. When we can utilize the ocean for water, we can utilize the ocean water for all sorts of purposes with water desalinization plants. If the UN had the idea of really taking care of mankind and doing the right thing for mankind, instead of wanting to reduce the population and kill off 99% of the population or 95% of the population, they would be encouraging countries to build water desalinization plants all over the world. They would make water so plentiful that water would not be the precious commodity of the 21st century. Common sense tells me this. Common sense should tell you this. They go on to state that agricultural yields are expected to drop in most tropical and subtropical regions, and in temperate regions too. If the temperature increase is more than a few degrees centigrade, drying of continental interiors, such as Central Asia, the African shield, and the Great Plains of the United States, is also forecast. These changes could cause, at a minimum, disruptions in land use and food supply, and the range of diseases such as malaria may expand. Global warming is a modern problem, complicated, involving the entire world, tangled up with difficult issues such as poverty, economic development, and population growth. Dealing with it will not be easy. Ignoring it will be worse. Over a decade ago, most countries joined an international treaty, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, to begin to consider what can be done to reduce global warming and to cope with whatever temperature increases are inevitable. Recently, a number of nations have approved an addition to the treaty called the Kyoto Protocol, which has more powerful and legally binding measures. The protocol is expected to take effect soon. And since 1988, an intergovernmental panel on climate change has reviewed scientific research and provided governments with summaries and advice on climate problems. Human activity, particularly the burning of fossil fuels, has been the blanket of greenhouse gas around the earth thicker. The resulting increase in global temperatures is altering the complex web of systems that allow life to thrive on Earth, such as cloud cover, rainfall, wind patterns, ocean currents, and the disruption of plant and animal species. No mention ever of aerial spraying that's been going on for decades, or at least this last decade. More of the sun's energy is being trapped in the atmosphere, and much more of the world's carbon in the form of carbon dioxide is resting in the air rather than in trees, soil, and subterranean deposits. Life on Earth is made possible by energy from the sun, which arrives mainly in the form of visible light. About 30% of sunlight is scattered back into the space by the outer atmosphere, but the rest reaches the Earth's surface, which reflects it in the form of a calmer, more slow-moving type of energy called infrared radiation. This is the sort of heat thrown off by an electronic grill before the bars begin to glow red. Infrared radiation is carried slowly aloft by air currents, and its eventual escape into space is delayed by greenhouse gases such as water vapor, carbon dioxide, ozone, and methane. Greenhouse gases make up only about 1% of the atmosphere, but they act like a blanket around the Earth, or like the glass roof of a greenhouse. They trap the heat and keep the planet some 30 degrees centigrade warmer than it would be otherwise. Human activities are making the blanket thicker. That's right. You and I and our activities are making the blanket thicker. The natural levels of these gases are being supplemented by emissions of carbon dioxide from the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas, by additional methane and nitrous oxide produced by farming activities and changes in land use, and by several long-lived industrial gases that do not occur naturally. These changes are happening at unprecedented speed. If emissions continue to grow at current rates, it is almost certain that atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide will double from pre-industrial levels during the 21st century. It is possible they will triple. The result, known as the enhanced greenhouse effect, is a warming of the Earth's surface and lower atmosphere. Computer climate models estimate that the average global temperature will rise by 1.4 to 5.8 degrees centigrade by the year 2100. A temperature increase of 0.6 degrees centigrade occurred last century. Even a small rise in temperature will be accompanied by changes in climate, in such things as cloud cover, precipitation, wind patterns, and the duration of seasons. In a world that is crowded with under stress, once again, in a world that is crowded and under stress, millions of people depend on weather patterns such as monsoon rains to continue as they have in the past. Changes in a minimum will be difficult and disruptive. Carbon dioxide is responsible for over 60% of the enhanced greenhouse effect. Humans are burning coal, oil, and natural gas at a rate that is much, much faster than the speed at which these fossil fuels were created. This is releasing the carbon stored in the fuels into the atmosphere and upsetting the carbon cycle. The millennia-old precisely balanced system by which carbon is exchanged between the air, the oceans, and land vegetation. Currently, atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide are rising by over 10% every 20 years. Some climate change is now inevitable because of past and current emissions. The climate does not respond immediately to external changes, but after 150 years of industrialization, global warming has momentum, and it will continue to affect the Earth's natural systems for hundreds of years, even if greenhouse gas emissions are reduced and atmospheric levels stop rising. Listeners, if this isn't a load of propaganda to reach epic proportions, I don't know what is. And that's why we're covering it tonight. It's a mess. I'm looking for Senator Imhoff's statement regarding the Kyoto Protocol from January 5th of this year. And I don't seem to find it. Boy, I sure come across a lot of good information lately. I'm not bragging, I'm just stating. and I appreciate your support for this broadcast, and I appreciate more support for this broadcast. It's a major effort to do this, and it's most important to keep it going. Most important for you to support Melody Cederstrom and her discount gold and silver trading. If you don't support her and what she does, it's going to make it very difficult to continue. And we need to continue. There's just so much going on. So much going on. Once again, that last paragraph, which they state, is their own website, UNFCCC. Some climate change is now inevitable because of past and current emissions. The climate does not respond immediately to external changes, but after 150 years of industrialization, global warming has momentum and will continue to affect the Earth and natural systems for hundreds of years, even if greenhouse gas emissions are reduced and atmospheric levels stop rising. Totalitarian propaganda, listeners. Totalitarian propaganda. The hogwash of it all. The UN system. The scientists who get their paycheck from the UN system, or wherever they get their paycheck, to keep their sustenance in place, to keep their high-priced cars running, to keep their high-priced homes livable, to continue to raise their families in the global system, are going along with this propaganda. We've been inundated with propaganda for years. The propaganda started with the war between the states. The propaganda started with the Civil War. And soon after the Civil War, it was almost mandatory to become an attorney or a lawyer to be in politics. Since that time, we have nothing but lawyers for politicians, manipulating us into communitarianism in America, which is communism with a new face. We have 21 days before the Kyoto Protocol comes into force. They promoted it. So, from the UNFCCC, extra strength weather. Current evidence of climate change. Think about the last hour. Think about the previous hours I've done in the past about weather modification. Think about the information on AmericanExpose.com. And listen to this. And I know where it's going, and I haven't even read this. More frequent and powerful cyclones and hurricanes, more frequent and intense floods and droughts, a recent increase in, quote, extreme weather events, end quote, has been too pronounced to explain away as random. Scientists say it's an indication that climate change already has begun. One climate variation appears to be an increase in variation itself. There are wider swings in what is normal weather. Now, see the propaganda there? I didn't even pre-read this. I never pre-read, hardly ever. It makes me sick to prepare for shows because I know so much about what's been going on all these years and what's going to happen in the future. So everything's spontaneous. I've said this from the very, very start. But you got to understand the environmental modification, the weather modification to bring about the results of what they're propagandizing here, of which we have 21 days before this comes into force. And I continue. Entitled, Current Evidence of Climate Change, Extra Strength Weather. The trend toward more powerful storms and hotter, longer, dry periods is predicted by computer models and reflects common sense. Warmer temperatures mean greater evaporation, and a warmer atmosphere is able to hold more moisture. Hence, there is more water aloft that can fall as precipitation. Similarly, dry regions are apt to lose still more moisture if the weather is hotter. This exacerbates droughts and desertification. In Africa's large catchment basins of Niger, Lake Chad, and Senegal, total available water has decreased by 40 to 60%. And desertification has been worsened by lower average annual rainfall, runoff, and soil moisture, especially in southern, northern, and western Africa. The Rhine floods of 1996 and 1997, the Chinese floods of 1998, the East European floods of 1998 and 2002, the Mozambique and European floods of 2000, and the monsoon-based flooding of 2004 in Bangladesh, which left 60% of the country underwater, are an indication that storms indeed are growing more powerful. Arctic air temperatures increased by about 5 degrees centigrade during the 20th century, 10 times faster than the global mean surface temperature. In the Russian Arctic, buildings are collapsing because permafrost under their foundations has melted. Snow cover has declined by some 10% in the mid and high latitudes of the northern hemisphere since the late 1960s. The annual duration of lake and river ice cover apparently shortened by about 2 weeks during the 20th century. You've got to be joking. Almost all mountain glaciers in non-polar regions retreated during the 20th century. The overall volume of glaciers in Switzerland decreased by two-thirds. Scientists have observed climate-induced changes in at least 420 physical processes in biological species or communities. In the Alps, some plant species have been migrated upward by 1 to 4 meters per decade, and some plants previously found only on mountaintops have disappeared. In Europe, mating and egg-laying of some bird species have occurred earlier in the season. In the United Kingdom, for example, egg-laying by 20 to 65 species, including long-distance migrants, advanced by an average of 8 days between 1971 and 1995. It gets juicier as we go along. Senator Inhofe again blasts environmental fearmongers, dated January 5th, 2005. Coming up.
Listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
A bird that never lands? One does exist. Learn more about it in today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment's host, Ian Taylor.
The small bird known as the chimney swift is unmatched in its flying ability. These little birds are so adapted to the air that they have only small, weak feet that do not permit them to walk or perch like other birds. In fact, their Latin name even means without feet. When swifts do come to rest, they do so against a vertical surface like a wall. They are often found resting inside the protection of chimneys, which led to their English name, chimney swift. A large flock of swifts may sight a chimney and begin circling it in smaller and smaller circles. Finally, the birds closest to the chimney enter it, followed by the rest. One person reported seeing a flock of 10,000 swifts enter one chimney over a period of 37 minutes. When David was cursed by Shimei, he realized that the curse would be of no effect because he was innocent of murdering members of Saul's family. In Proverbs chapter 26, verse 2, his son Solomon compares unjust curses to a bird which never lands, meaning that when people speak evil of us or curse us, if what they say is untrue or unjust, their words will have no effect. It is God's wisdom to think of unjust things that are said about us as being like the swift, always in flight and never landing upon us.
To get a complete set of transcripts from Creation Moments programs, ask about the book Letting God Create Your Day when you visit us online at creationmoments.com. Join us again for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
You are listening to the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network. We do not have freedom of speech because the Constitution gives it to us. The constitutional amendment was written to keep the government from taking our freedom away. The Creator gave us our rights, but He also gives us the capacity to do evil or usurp the rights of others. Our individual rights end where the rights of another begin. No one has the right to do evil because evil can never be right. Those who would seek to limit your right to speak or hear the truth are the same who seek to subjugate, control, and enslave you. Freedom is not free. Support the Worldwide First Amendment Radio Network by going to firstamendmentradio.com on the Internet and following the instructions there to support us. Thank you for listening.
Computer models predict severe storms are occurring more frequently, according to the UN website, the UNFCCC. Across Europe, the growing season is controlled. Once again, across Europe, the growing season in controlled. Mixed species gardens lengthened by 10.8 days from 1959 to 1993. Butterflies, dragonflies, moths, beetles, and other insects are now living at higher latitudes and altitudes where previously it was too cold to survive. That's what they say. What is going on with the Hegelian dialectic? What is going on with the aerial spraying that's been going on worldwide, not just in this country, listeners? There's much more to the UNFCCC website. It will be on AmericanExpose.com as soon as Darren's able to do so. Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, one of the brightest points of being in Oklahoma, dated January 5, 2005, several days after the gigantic earthquake causing the tidal wave, calling it a tsunami. Senator Inhofe states, as I said on the Senate floor on July 28, 2003, much of the debate over global warming is predicated on fear rather than science. I call the threat of catastrophic global warming the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. A statement that, to put it mildly, was not viewed kindly by environmental extremists and their elitist organizations. I also pointed out in a lengthy committee report that these same environmental extremists exploit the issue for fundraising purposes. raking in millions of dollars, even using federal taxpayer dollars to finance their campaigns. For these groups, the issue of catastrophic global warming is not just a favored fundraising tool. In truth, it's more fundamental than that. Put simply, man-induced global warming is an article of religious faith. Therefore, contending that its central tenets are flawed is, to them, heresy of the most despicable kind. Furthermore, scientists who challenge its tenets are attacked, sometimes personally, for blindly ignoring the so-called scientific consensus. That's, quote, scientific consensus, end quote. But that's not all. Because of their skeptical views, they are contemptuously dismissed for being, quote, out of the mainstream, end quote. This is, it seems to me, highly ironic. Aren't scientists supposed to be non-conforming and question consensus? Nevertheless, it's not hard to read between the lines. Skeptic and out of mainstream are thinly veiled code phrases, meaning anyone who doubts alarmist orthodoxy is, in short, a quack. I have insisted all along that the climate change debate should be based on fundamental principles of science, not religion. Ultimately, I hope it will be decided by hard facts and data, and by serious scientists committed to the principles of sound science. Instead of censoring skeptical viewpoints, as my alarmist friends favor, these scientists must be heard. And I will do my part to make sure that they are heard. Since my detailed climate change speech in 2003, the so-called skeptics continue to speak out. What they are saying and what they are showing is devastating to the alarmists. They have amassed additional scientific evidence, convincingly refuting the alarmists' most cherished assumptions and beliefs. New evidence has emerged that further undermines their conclusions, most notably those of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, one of the major pillars of authority cited by extremists and climate alarmists. This evidence has come to light in very interesting times. Just last month, the 10th Conference on the Parties, the COP10, to the Framework Convention on Climate Change, convened in Buenos Aires to discuss Kyoto's implementation and measures to pursue beyond Kyoto. As some of my colleagues know, Kyoto goes into effect on February 16th. I think, with the exception of Russia, an exception that I will explain later, the nations that ratified Kyoto and agreed to submit to its mandates are making a very serious mistake. What I ought to do here is change glasses. That's better. In addition, last month, popular author Dr. Michael Crichton, who has questioned the wisdom of those who trumpet a scientific consensus, released a book called State of Fear, which is premised on the global warming debate. I am happy to report that Dr. Crichton's new book reached number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. I highly recommend the book to all my colleagues. Dr. Crichton, a medical doctor and scientist, very cleverly weaves a compelling presentation of the scientific facts of climate change, with ample footnotes and documentation throughout, into a gripping plot. From what I can gather, Dr. Crichton's book is designed to bring some sanity to the global warming debate. In the author's message at the end of the book, he refreshingly states what scientists have suspected for years. Quote, "We are also in the midst of a natural warming trend that began about 1850 as we emerged from a 400-year cold spell known as the Little Ice Age," end quote. Dr. Crichton states that, quote, "Nobody knows how much of the present warming trend might be natural phenomenon," end quote, and, quote, "Nobody knows how much of the present trend might be man-made," end quote. And for those who see impending disaster in the coming century, Dr. Creston urges calm. Quote, I suspect that people of 2100 will be much richer than we are, consume more energy, have a smaller global population, and enjoy more wilderness than we have today. I don't think we have to worry about them, end quote. For those who don't worry or induce such worry in others, State of Fear has a very simple message. Stop worrying and stop spreading fear. Throughout the book, fictional environmental organizations are more focused on raising money, principally by scaring potential contributors with bogus scientific claims and predictions of a global apocalypse, than with saving the environment. Here we have, as the saying goes, art imitating life. As my colleagues will remember from a floor speech I gave last year, this is part and parcel of what these organizations peddle to the general public. Their fear-mongering knows no bounds. Just consider the debate over mercury emissions. President Bush proposed the first ever cap to reduce mercury emissions from power plants by 70%. True to form, these groups said he was allowing more mercury into the air. Go figure. As I mentioned earlier, several nations, including the United States, met in Buenos Aires in December for the 10th round of the international climate change negotiations. I'm happy to report that the U.S. delegation held firm both in its categorical rejection of Kyoto and the questionable science behind it. Paula Dobrzynski, Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs and the leader of the U.S. delegation, put it well when she told the conference, quote, science tells us that we cannot say with any certainty what constitutes a dangerous level of warming, and therefore what level must be avoided, end quote. Ms. Dobrzynski and her team also rebuffed attempts by the European Union to drag the U.S. into discussions concerning post-Kyoto climate change commitments. With the ink barely dry on Kyoto ratification, not to mention what the science of climate change is telling us, Ms. Dobrzynski was right in dubbing post-2012 talks premature. Quote-unquote, premature. It was clear from discussions in Buenos Aires that Kyoto supporters desperately want the U.S. to impose on itself mandatory greenhouse gas emission controls. Moreover, there was considerable discussion, but no apparent resolution, over how to address emissions from developing countries such as India and especially China, which over the coming decades will be the world's leadest emitter of greenhouse gases. But developing nations, most notably China, remained adamant in Buenos Aires in opposing any mandatory greenhouse gas reductions, now or in the future. Securing this commitment, remember, was a necessary component for U.S. ratification of Kyoto, as reflected in the Byrd-Hagel resolution, which the Senate passed 95-0. Without that commitment, Kyoto, at least in the U.S., is dead. Kyoto goes into force on February 16th, according to the EU Environment Ministry. Most EU member states won't meet their Kyoto targets. They may do so only on paper due to Russia's ratification of the treaty. Russia, of course, ratified Kyoto not because its government believes in catastrophic global warming. It doesn't. But because ratification was Russia's key to joining the World Trade Organization. Also under Kyoto, Russia can profit from selling emissions credits to the EU and continue business as usual without undertaking economically harmful emissions reductions. As talks in Buenos Aires revealed, if alarmists can't get what they want at the negotiating table, they will try other means. I was told by reliable sources that some delegation members of the European Union subtly hinted that America's rejection of Kyoto could be grounds for a challenge under the WTO. I surely hope this was just a hypothetical suggestion and not something our European friends are actively and seriously considering. Such a move, I predict, would be devastating to U.S.-EU relations, not to mention the WTO itself. But I suspect it's not just hypothetical. The lawsuit is the stock and trade of environmental activists, and we are witnessing a new crop of global warming lawsuits now being leveled at individual U.S. companies and the U.S. itself. In Buenos Aires, Earth Justice, a San Francisco-based environmental group, and the Center for International Law announced plans to seek a ruling from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that the U.S., because of its supposed contribution to global warming, is causing environmental degradation in the Arctic and therefore violating the human rights of Alaska's Inuits or Eskimos. As the New York Times wrote, quote, the commission, an investigative arm of the Organization of American States, has no enforcement powers, but a declaration that the United States has violated the Inuit's rights could create the foundation for an eventual lawsuit, either against the United States in an international court or against American companies in a U.S. court, said a number of legal experts, including some aligned with industry, end quote. The Times didn't mention that such lawsuits already have been filed in the U.S. Elliot Spencer, New York State Attorney General, along with eight other state attorneys general, mainly from the Northeast, last year sued five coal-burning electric utilities in the Midwest. The reason? Quote, given that these are among the largest carbon dioxide polluters in the world, Mr. Spencer wrote, it is essential that the court direct them to reduce their emissions, end quote. To me, this is a clear-cut sign of desperation by the alarmists. But I'm not surprised. President Bush has rejected Kyoto. The United States Senate rejected Kyoto 95-0. The United States Senate rejected the McCain-Lieberman bill 55-43. And there is little hope that Congress will pass mandatory greenhouse gas reductions, at least not in the near future. So resorting to the courts is their last best hope. I hope the courts have enough sense and moderation to reject these lawsuits out of hand. I am interested, for one, to see how Mr. Spitzer quantifies with scientific precision just how these particular companies have contributed to climate change. How is it, one might ask, that emissions specifically from American electric power are causing rising sea levels, droughts, and hurricanes? Such efforts fly in the face of compelling new scientific evidence that makes a mockery of these lawsuits. By now, most everyone familiar with the climate change debate knows about the hockey stick graph constructed by Dr. Michael Mann and colleagues, which shows that temperature in the Northern Hemisphere remained relatively stable over 900 years, then spiked upward in the 20th century. The hockey stick graph was featured prominently in the IPCC's third assessment report, published in 2001. The conclusion inferred from the hockey stick is that industrialization, which spawned widespread use of fossil fuels, is causing the planet to warm. I spent considerable time examining this work in my 2003 speech, because man effectively erased the well-known phenomenon of the medieval warming period when, by the way, it was warmer than it is today. And the little ice age, I didn't find it very credible. I find it even less credible now. But don't take my word for it. Just ask Dr. Hans von Storch, a noted German climate researcher who, along with colleagues, published a devastating finding in the September 30th, 2004 issue of the journal Science. As the authors wrote, quote, we were able to show in a publication in Science that this hockey stick graph contains assumptions that are not permissible. Methodologically, it is wrong, rubbish, end quote. Dr. von Storch and colleagues discovered that the Mann hockey stick had severely underestimated past climate variability, and it in a contemporary on Dr. von Storch's paper, T.J. Osborne and K.R. Breffa, prominent paleoclimatologists from the University of East Anglia, stressed the importance of the findings. As they wrote, quote, "The message of the study by von Storch et al. Is that existing reconstructions of the NH, or the Northern Hemisphere temperature, of recent centuries may systematically underestimate the true centennial variability of climate," end quote. And, quote, "If the true natural variability of NH, the Northern Hemisphere temperature, is indeed greater than is currently accepted, the extent to which recent warming can be viewed as unusual would need to be reassessed," end quote. In other words, in obliterating the medieval warming period and the little ice age, man's hockey stick just doesn't pass muster. Dr. von Storch is one of many critics of Michael Mann's hockey stick. To recount just one example, these geophysicists from the University of Utah, in April 7, 2004 edition of Geophysical Research Letters, concluded that man's methods used to create his temperature reconstruction were deeply flawed. In fact, their judgment is harsher than that. As they wrote, man's results are, quote, based on using endpoints in computing changes in an oscillating series, end quote, and are, quote, just bad science, end quote. I repeat, quote, just bad science, end quote. These findings come alongside a spat of new reports that, at least in the eyes of the media, supposedly confirm the consensus on global warming. Quote, the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, end quote, released last fall, perfectly fits that mold. Quote, Arctic peril seen in warming, end quote, blared a headline in the New York Times. As the Times wrote, quote, the findings support the broad but politically controversial scientific consensus that global warming is caused mainly by rising atmospheric concentrations of heat-trapping greenhouse gases, and that the Arctic is the first region to feel its effects, end quote. What do we really know about temperatures in the Arctic? Let's take a closer look. As Oregon State University climatologist George Taylor has shown, Arctic temperatures are actually slightly cooler today than they were in the 1930s. As Dr. Taylor has explained, it's all relative. In other words, it depends on the specific time period chosen in making temperature comparisons. Quote, the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, end quote, Dr. Taylor wrote, quote, appears to be guilty of selective use of data. Many of the trends described in the document began in the 1960s or 1970s, cool decades in much of the world, and end in the warmer 1990s and early 2000s. So, for example, temperatures have warmed at least 40 years, and the implication, if present trends continue, is that massive warming will occur in the next century, end quote. Dr. Taylor concluded, quote, yet data are readily available for the 1930s and early 1940s when temperatures were comparable to and probably higher than those observed today. Why not start the trend there? Because there is no net warming over the last 65 years, end quote. This is pretty convincing stuff. But one might say this is only one scientist, while nearly 300 scientists from several countries, including the United States, signed on to the Arctic Report. Mr. President, I want to submit for the record, a list of scientists compiled by the Center for Science and Public Policy from several countries, including the United States, whose published work shows current Arctic temperature is no higher than temperature in the 1930s and 1940s. For example, according to a group of seven scientists in 2003 issue of the Journal of Climate, quote, in contrast to the global and hemispheric temperature, the maritime Arctic temperature was higher in the late 1930s through the early 1940s. than in the 1990s, end quote. Or how about this excerpt from the 2000 International Journal of Climatology by Dr. Ramud Pasadalak of Nicholas Copernicus University in Torin, Poland. Quote, the highest temperature since the beginning of instrumental observation occurred clearly in the 1930s and can be attributed to changes in atmospheric circulation, end quote. Despite this evidence, alarmism is alive and well. As you can see behind me, the Washington Post today ran an editorial cartoon that actually blames the Indian Ocean tsunami on global warming. Are we to believe now that global warming is causing earthquakes? The tsunami, of course, was caused by an earthquake off Sumatra's coast, deep beneath the sea floor, completely disconnected from whatever the climate was doing at the surface. Regrettably, the tsunami warming connection is yet another facet of the, quote, state of fear, end quote, alarmists have concocted. As Terrence Corcoran of Canada's Financial Post wrote, quote, the urge to capitalize on the horror of Asia is just too great for some to resist if it might help their cause. Green websites are already filling up with references to tsunami risks associated with global warming, end quote. To address this, let's ask some simple questions. Is global warming causing more extreme weather events of greater intensity? And is it causing the sea levels to rise? The answer to both is an emphatic no. And basically, that's all I have time for in this report by Senator Imhoff. Connecting the dots to all this, listeners, is very easy. Simple. Go to the website, AmericanExpose.com. It's only begun to show you the proof of the totalitarian control being maneuvered and manipulated on mankind today. And yet, our sons and daughters and fathers and mothers and boyfriends and girlfriends, where are they? They're off to Iraq so they can get a college education once they come out, if they come out alive. The setup is thoroughly in place, listeners. It's your responsibility for you and your family and your country to research for yourself to prove me wrong, and I wish you could. But you can't, and you won't. Good night. God bless you all.